one day someone who was very skeptical of unschooling said, well, how do you get all those things in front of your children? And I said, I just strew it around.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm Sandra Dodd. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have a webpage. It's sandradodd.com, and there are many pages there, mostly about unschooling and parenting. In the old days, before the internet was so big, all the homeschoolers were in one place on a user group. I learned a lot because we were all mixed together. One day, someone who was very skeptical of unschooling said, well, how do you get all those things in front of your children? And I said, I just strew it around. I just strew their paths with interesting things. And the concept stuck. The idea is to just have things in your house that are interesting enough to pick up and turn over and mess with. And that can cover a whole lot of science and history just all by itself. And math. If you have a little building set. And I find things used at thrift stores, or there have been things that were given away at fast food drive-thrus, and we just collected four or five sets so you could build something bigger. Or magnets, maps, books. There's a book in our bathroom right now about archaeology. I didn't say anything to anyone. I just put it in there. We have a little bookshelf in the back in the bathroom. And my 15-year-old son this morning came out and said, did you see in that archaeology book that they think they know why people believed in the Minotaur and the maze? And I said, no. And he told me a long story about some archaeologist dig on an island off Greece. And I didn't, if no one had ever mentioned that book, if it looked like no one had ever read that book, it wouldn't hurt my feeling because I just put the things out there and then periodically switch them around. I think I got that idea probably from when I was studying education. I studied education in the early 70s, which was the height of the school reform days. And I was in New Mexico, which was kind of a hotbed of school reform. There was a book written called The Open Classroom by people in New Mexico. And so I went to school with professors who just took for granted that the schools would be reformed. All of the research of the 60s and 70s was going to be implemented in a flash and everything would be better. So I was young and idealistic and wanted to believe that too. But one of the things that they taught us in teaching us how the open classroom worked is it doesn't make sense to try to drag a class of 30 kids through one activity. Just put the interesting things out, and they'll discover it, and they'll show each other, and they'll ask you questions. And I did that a little when I was teaching, and it worked. And I've done it with my children. It worked. But before we had children, my husband and I were together for 7 years, and we did that with each other. I mean, we were involved in the Medieval Studies Club. We made costumes. He made armor. We made tents together. That took geometry, but we didn't say so. You know, it was making tents out of trying to go from historical paintings and try to figure out how with triangles and rectangles they had made a tent with one center pole. And so we had a lot of activity like that between ourselves. And had a lot of friends who were artists and interested in history, interested in music. And when you have the information swirling like that, you start to see that everything's connected. Some of the things that we have from when we were younger are in our house, and the kids will just pick it up, and they know things about those items. Or they will say, how do they keep the pattern straight on those India print bedspreads? How do they decide to do that? I don't know. Let's go find out. But we can pull up a sample of block-printed cloth from the house. And I know some people live in houses that look more like motel rooms, and I don't know how they do that sort of thing. But it's been easy for us to just rearrange the things in our house so that they discover something new.
That was the other idea. It was your home is a kind of museum.
And I think everyone's can be. We went to our neighbor's house, and he pulled out photos of when he was growing up, and they were places that my son and I were about to go and visit. And, you know, just people don't think to ask. You don't think to pull a book off someone's shelf and say, oh, you know this author? It's autographed. I think people forget. They think of museums as other buildings far away that belong to the state, and their house is just a house. But sometimes that word just gets in the way of seeing the possibilities and how rich each thing, each place is. We found some castle blocks. I saw them when my son was a baby, but they were very expensive, and they're from Spain. But having seen those, I think it's worth looking in catalogs of things you can't afford, because then when you're at the thrift store and you see it, you know what it is. And they make really nice castle models. I don't ever say, all right, attention, everyone, I'm putting out the castle blocks. They just appear. And then castles are made, and people talk about things, and they talk about particular castles they're trying to do, or why this sort of arrangement would work, because since they played it last, they've discovered something new, either in a game they played or a movie they watched or something they read. And after it's not getting any attention, then it goes back away and something else might come out. I have a bowl of rocks. They look different wet than they do dry. Sometimes if people are just sitting around talking, it's worth just getting a little bowl of water and sticking different rocks in it while you're talking. Doesn't interrupt the conversation, and they can, you know, they can play with it or not as they want to. We have jigsaw puzzles. When I was in England last time, we bought at thrift stores for just, you know, the equivalent of a dollar, 50p, 49p, jigsaw puzzles of things particular to England, two of the history of the kings and queens of England. And we've worked them, not with the intent to learn anything, just to work them. But everyone, adult or child, who was involved in that, discovered something they hadn't known before. And while we were working it, we just talked. Not about kings and queens, just about whatever was going on in our lives. So I think there's an advantage to not focusing, to not saying, we're going to work this puzzle because it's history. We just worked a puzzle. Some history came, some current social stuff, some personal stories about what had been going on, some right. questions about things totally unrelated. And if there's enough swirl of information and exchange, all kinds of things will come up. They don't need to come up linearly. If one kid knows about Roman numerals at the age of 6 and the other one doesn't know till 12, so what? The first time anyone learns about Roman numerals in the real world is when they see them and don't know what they are. And they ask, somebody tells them. You know, it's not brain surgery. But it's more interesting when you're seeing something real than you're getting it because it's September 13th and you're in the fifth grade and that's what the book says you learn. So we found it to be really fun to discover things, but it's easier to discover things when they're there to discover. Maybe string's a little bit like hiding Easter eggs, but not to that extent. You know, there just might be a couple or three things out and about. It's like a conversation piece. It's like putting out a pretty book on a coffee table or flowers, you know, an arrangement of flowers. It's no more than that, only it's more likely to be a puzzle. And although it's incidental, that's the core of my method, if you want to call it a method, is to just keep our lives so busy and so varied that incidental learning happens all the time. If friends of mine, you know, my own age or younger, come over to visit, they sort of get caught up in whatever's going on too. And if the adults here are being playful and curious and open, visitors are more likely to be that way too. Whereas the same people visiting at someone else's house who's being a little more somber and, you know, mature for want of another word, more boring, will do that. You know, they'll go there and they'll sit and drink beer and watch the game or whatever. But they come here and we're working a puzzle or building something and they get into that too. It's fun. We do things that are just fun. You can hardly walk by without picking it up and messing with it too. Sometimes someone, you know, my husband and one of the kids will be doing something in one room, and in the next room some other friends are over and they're playing a video game, and in another room or outside, you know, another kid and somebody else is doing something else. That also is the ideal of the open classroom. Their ideal was not to be sitting in desks reading, but to be able to sit in a soft place, in a dark place, in a private place, or wherever you wanted to read. So they tried to have interesting places where kids could get away from the other kids. And then there would be, for history, timelines and costumes and sort of like children's museums try to do now, where there are things that you can try on. And for math, lots of what now are common, but then were not common in the 60s and 70s, math manipulative toys. If someone tried to do that, and lots of people did, the problem was when they did the experiments, the kids were there voluntarily, or it was a lab school connected to a university where the parents were grad students or professors, and so their kids got to go to school at the university, kind of like a glorified daycare, but it was a model school or, you know, lab school where they did tests on the kids. So those kids were being taught by professors and grad students who were doing research in school reform. Their parents were into it. They thought it was great. And the kids didn't have to be there. That's what made it work. Turns out in the long run, when they tried it in regular public school settings, it didn't work. The people who did look at it said it would have worked if the teachers had volunteered to be in that sort of program and if every child there had a choice whether to be in that program or a traditional classroom.
I wonder, I wonder, I wonder what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder what Tina can possibly do. She can play with her blocks, or go throw some rocks, or climb a tree and look at the view. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I see someone's hand, I see someone's hair, I hear someone go peekaboo. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. She crawls on the floor, she looks round the door, she's trying to wear my shoe. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I see someone's hair, I see someone's toe, but I can't guess possibly who. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do. I wonder, I wonder, I wonder, what Tina can possibly do.
You are listening to Radio Free School.
The failure was compulsory attendance, not the learning method. Almost every piece of routine damage that schools can do to a child, parents can do at home. Parents can make their kids hate math. They can make them never want to read a book again. They can make them want nothing more than to grow up and get away. So yeah. With unschooling, when people ask me what I think makes it work, I tell them the kids have to have a choice. There's a learning curve that I see with unschooled kids, and that is they seem to be ahead for the first few years. And then there's a period of time, just roughly from, I guess, when they're about 10, 9 or 10 to about 12, when they can seem behind. And then after they're 12 or 13, zoom, they look ahead. They seem to be ahead again. And so it's weird when people go, what happened? What happened? You know, why are these 12-year-old unschoolers and their parents panicky and they feel inadequate and their neighbors are going, hoo-hoo, you don't know anything. All of a sudden, they've zoomed ahead again. And I think part of it is puberty. Part of it is their learning to read. I don't know what to say about the rest. There just seems to be in school, there's a period when children are 11 or 12, when they've just been crammed full of math facts and geographical facts and science terminology, and they just seem full to bursting of knowledge. And the kids at home may be still playing Pokemon and, you know, coloring books and, you know, and they look up and the kids are naming names of places and things that they don't know. They're reading textbooks. They're doing long division or things that you can see, you know, across the room. What are they doing? I don't know what they're doing. I can't do that. They're writing in cursive. And the kids who stayed home are not doing those. But then what seems to happen with the unschoolers that I've met and talked with and asked about this, it seemed like, sure enough with them too, that when the kids got 13 or 14, a kind of maturity came upon them, and they said, oh, well, if I guess if I want to learn cursive, I just practice it. Is this it? And they do it. You know, they look at some and they go, is this all? They figured out on their own how to do math, and they're multiplying double digits in their head. They might not know how to write it down on paper, but they know how to do it. They start to develop their own model of, you know, map of the world and history of the universe and stuff. All of their facts are starting to gel into a model of the universe. They're understanding a lot of things and making a lot of connections. And about that time, the kids at school get all burned out and realize that all these facts they're learning are only leading to another year of facts. It's like Rumpelstiltskin. Oh, you turn that straw into gold? Next room, bigger, more straw. Oh, yeah, you don't get to keep the gold. And so they're getting very irritated by the time they're 14, whereas the homeschooled, the unschooled kids are going, oh, yeah, this is cool. I'm glad I didn't go to school. Another thing that happened with my kids and with some others I've known is when they get to be 14 or 15, they've either gotten a job, gotten a really cool volunteer position, become involved in a hobby they have so that they're at a position of teaching, like whether it's karate or horseback riding or ice skating. They've gotten to the point where they know enough that they're a senior student, and they are given some position of responsibility. Whatever it is, if they're given something real, and sometimes it's specifically because they're not in school during the day, and they're given the kind of responsibility that's given to an adult, in a way it makes them an adult. They feel that shift of not being one of the kids anymore, being one of the adults. And you see a change in their posture and their bearing and the way adults treat them. And so at a point when the kids at school are told, because they're just barely in high school maybe, you know, they're the young kids of a batch of kids who are bullying them, picking on them, they're tired of it, they see no end in sight. The best they can hope for is to get good grades so they can go to college. They're at that sort of point of greatest dismay of public schools, while the kids their age who are unschooled are saying, huh, I wonder if I'm going to go to horse camp or if I should take a college class. I wonder if I should go to karate 3 times a week so I can get a black belt or whether I should go work at the gaming store. And the kids in school don't have any of those options. So at the same time that they are made small, the unschoolers have been made large. If families can make it through those few years, that rough hump of, oh, my kid hardly reads, he doesn't have cursive, he doesn't know the times tables, and he's 12, you know, he's starting to get whiskers, and he doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
All the kids at school see him all together, because that's just before a lot of them start to say, to hell with this, this is crazy, why am I doing this? A lot of the things that I had learned because someone took an interest in me as a person, and so I've done that for other people my whole life. If someone mentions that they're interested or curious about something I like or that I know, I'll lend them a book, I'll bring them over, show them my stuff, and that's my way of paying back those people who helped me. But the kind of learning I was doing is the kind of learning I've tried to provide now for my children, which is, oh, you're interested in this? I know someone who knows that. Or, I don't know that answer, but I know someone who does. So I try to hook them up with real people who know real things, and not in any kind of formal apprentice way, although right now my middle son, Marty, who's 16, is making boots with a friend of ours who has been doing leather work for a few years, and he's making historical boots partly for medievalists, partly for Civil War, a little bit Civil War, but mostly Renaissance-style boots, and he's sold to Disneyland and some movies. And so Marty's doing that, and he's learning what is and isn't historical, you know, for which period, what's period for different purposes and time periods. And then they just make boots that look old but are modern, have modern materials, and Marty knows all the difference. He knows what he's doing. So he gets paid not much, you know, minimum wage. He's doing that four afternoons a week. We lucked into that because we made friends with and paid attention to and sought out people who were creative and curious and busy. I don't know about Canada, but the United States has a mythology just as sure as Rome or Greece ever did. And part of that mythology is the phrase that just comes up as though it's a truth. All men are created equal. It's like, well, what do you mean? It almost gets like Animal Farm, where they want to create the equality after the fact. It's like, oh, no, you were going to do something special? That's no good. We want you to be equal. If you know more than the other kids, that's not fair. And there's the big whine, the underlying whine. That's not fair. And there are families who say, well, that's not fair. Your kids are homeschooled. And then the homeschooler, the school-at-home families go, well, that's not fair. Your kids aren't having to do work. But I don't believe people are created equal, and I don't believe life can be fair, unless fair means lowest common denominator, everybody suffers, nobody has any good time.
Learning for fun. There's two sides to that. Maybe you want to talk a bit about that.
At the risk of offending some people, it comes down to sin. It's a sin to have fun. The Christian work ethic, if it feels good, don't do it. If it feels good, it must be bad for you. Life is pain. Start to suffer. And I don't think that really does people any good. One of the studies on how people learn that was done, again, in experimental school in the 60s and 70s, was what is the optimal state of mind for learning? Schools try to get everyone very still and very quiet, and that's not optimal. People don't learn very well when they're sitting still, not moving their hands, not moving their feet, someone's talking at them. That's the optimal condition for taking a nap. But the optimal condition for learning is also not, you think a tiger is going to bite you and you're running and screaming and you get so full of adrenaline you want to puke. Somewhere between those two is the right place. And one way to get that mental state of arousal, of alertness, of curiosity is humor, music, fun. And school can't afford to do that, because if 25 kids at the same time think something's really neat and cool, they start to make noise. So school is set up to keep everyone at such a low mental wavelength that they can't really learn, but at least they're quiet. So at home, if things can be fun and interesting and cool, then it's easier to learn. I know for sure that you can't pour information into people. I know for sure you can't command that someone learn something right now and have that work. Fear doesn't work. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is something that all teachers learn, and then they promptly forget. Maslow's hierarchy of needs says that you can't learn unless you feel safe, loved, fed. You know, you're not cold, you're not hot, you're not hungry, you don't feel afraid. And yet there are still schools and families where kids are told, do this or you can't eat lunch, do this or I'll hit you, whatever. You know, some threat and some deprivation. Learn first, then reward. They're going to learn. They're learning a lot. They're learning to get the heck away from there as soon as they can. They're learning to sneak food under the desk. They're learning to tune out adults. They're learning to cheat and lie. I don't want my kids to learn those things. So I keep them happy. I keep them fed. I let them sleep when they want to sleep. I let them say, I don't want to do that right now, when they don't want to do that right now. And it makes a big difference, because then the level of arousal when they are excited about something is real. They don't have to fake being excited. They really can get excited, because they know it, they really can say no. That level of freedom and choice is unusual in our culture for anyone.
Lightning and thunder.
What is spiritual unschooling?
I have a page called Spiritual Unschooling, but what it is there were articles that seemed more about how parents felt or how parents viewed their children than is what they did. People don't become really good at unschooling without changing the way they see themselves in the world. So at the core of it, I think there's a philosophical shift that has to happen. Because if people want to overlay unschooling on same old business as usual life, it doesn't really fit very well. You have to remodel the house a bit. And what the new building parts have to do with spirituality, if it's just the idea of being aware of what your child actually is doing, not what the book says he ought to be doing, you know, to look directly at the person you're dealing with instead of looking at him through the lens, developmental colored lens or whatever. But then some people will say, okay, well then fine, I don't need to know anything about child development or cognition or learning theory. I don't need to know anything. Then I'll just look at my kids. Like, wait, you'll look at him with what? So I think there needs to be a balance of both. I think people who are going to take responsibility for their children's learning lives, as it were, need to know what stages people go through. You know, Piaget's stages of development are very helpful for people to know it. But that doesn't mean they should live by that in a moment-to-moment way. There are no hours in which we are teaching, and there are no hours in which the children are not learning. So it changes the fabric of your life. Sometimes when I've described unschooling, people have said, well, it sounds like unit studies. And I said, no. Because although we might go on a binge, you know, we might have a week where everyone really cares about Monty Python or whatever, you know, go, oh, I have something else. And we drag out all of our samples and connections and toys and, you know, whatever. And then we get tired of it. We're done. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a unit study because no one said, starting next Monday, we're going to do China. And on Friday, we're going to be through with China. When people plan a unit that way, not only is it artificial, you don't get that excited joy and curiosity that makes it work, but what if, speaking as someone in Albuquerque where hot air balloons are a lot, what if you're studying Japan and a hot air balloon lands in the vacant lot behind your house? You're going to shut the window because it's not about Japan? And that's the danger of unit studies, is you doggedly move along a path that you've set, regardless of what's actually happening in the world. And if someone wants to learn about Japan, what's the hurry? If they're going to move there, there's some things they really need to know now. If they're not going to move there, if it's just something they kind of have an interest in on the side, or even if it becomes their burning soul interest, and they decorate their house Japanese, and they collect Japanese art. Still, what's the hurry? They'll be learning about it for the rest of their lives. The more they like something, the more they will never stop learning about that till the day they die, or Alzheimer takes. I don't think there's a hurry, and I don't think telling children, come on, hurry up, there's more about Japan we haven't learned yet, hurry, helps them like Japan, or like the mother, or learn more. It's counter to all that. So where the spirituality comes in that, I think, partly is the trust that your child is an organism that wants to learn, that's how people grow. There's physical growth, which takes water and food and rest. There's mental growth, which takes input, you know, ideas, things to think about, things to try, things to touch. And then there's spiritual growth, which takes more and more understanding, an awareness of it's better to be sweet to other people than not. It's better to be generous with your neighbors than hateful. It's better to pet your cat nicely than to throw it around. At first, it's a practical consideration, but later on, as the children are looking at the world through older eyes, they start to see that, no matter whether the neighbor noticed or not, it made you a better person. No matter whether your cat would have done your stuff damage or not, it made you a better person. I think there's a spirituality there of respect given to the children being passed on. Some people try to force their children to share, teach them to share by making them share. But I've seen that if they have enough things and they don't feel needy and they don't feel desperate, then they're willing to share. And as they get older, they're generous with their space in the house and their money and their computers and their time and their attention. And it's partly because my husband and I have been really careful to be generous with them. That has built up in them. They have plenty. And they don't mind then when we can't give. If we're having a bad day, really flustered or something, frustrated, you know, cranky, they're okay because they know that when we're not that way, then they can have more attention or time, whatever they need. I'm speaking in St. Louis in October, and I plan to talk about the unexpected benefits of unschooling, because most of the best things that have happened, I didn't foresee. I just can't bring myself to think that a day spent laughing and smiling and doing things that are enjoyable is bad. When I've worked jobs, the days that we went in and someone had brought something funny, you know, or interesting, and a cute snack, those were the best days. And those things are so small. But as to spirituality and unschooling, I think the relationship a parent builds with the child, if it's going to be a really good one, a really close one, has to go by a different model. Because our culture says, basically, that the parents own the children will be obedient, the parents can do what they want to, and then when the children are 18, they can leave. But until then, it's the parents' house, it's the parents' money, and the parents can say what happened. That's an extremely adversarial relationship, and it really can lead to no good except the future justification of other adversarial relationships. And it's not good for people's grandchildren. That's not much investment in two or three generations down. To teach your kids that the powerless lose, that older people get their way, richer people get their way. So it helps if the parents can say, well, okay, this is your house too. What do you want to do? Or give yourself a range of choices to offer the child. If a child's bored, you could offer three or four really cool things. Whereas my mom and thousands or millions of other moms say, if you're bored, mop the floor. If you're bored, you can go pull weeds, which is punishing a child for communicating with. I see my children as whole people whose lives are unfolding now. They may have memories as vivid as mine. And what I do and say now will be part of their lives after I'm dead. And do I want to be the Wicked Witch? Do I want to be a really stupid character that they grow up and live in reaction to and avoidance of? And so if I see them as whole, then I see that as they grow bigger, I grow smaller in their universe. There's another put-down, a traditional put-down, which is you're not the center of the universe. And I think, well, then what is? You know, are you talking astrological universe? Are you talking personal universe? Because I am the center of my universe. I see it out my eyes. I remember it from my memory. And when I die, my universe ends. So each of my children is the center of his or her universe. I see that as a spiritual difference in how you define your child in relationship to yourself. I think when some people think spirituality, they think active once-a-week sessions, designated religious center or something. But I see it more as a philosophical stance. Some parents who've asked me for advice, I've advised them to pretend they only have 300 no's. They have a little ticket they have to spend every time they say no. And they better save some. because some people use them all up before the kid's three. What if your child grows up and you still got 150 no tickets that you can chuck in the trash? That's pretty cool. Something that I need to credit to La Leche League and to Carol Rice, that same leader, and another woman named Lori Odner, who lives in Pennsylvania now. She's a very wise woman. They said, when I had a four-month-old baby named Kirby, they said, you should be his partner, not his adversary.
The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.